When dragged before the Iron Throne, Sir Lucamore fell to his knees, confessed his guilt, and begged the king for mercy. Jaehaerys might well have granted him same, but the errant knight made the fatal error of appending, "For the sake of my wives and children," to his plea. As Septon Barth observed, this was tantamount to throwing his crimes in the king's face. "When I rose against my uncle Maegor, two of his king's guard abandoned him to fight for me," Jaehaerys responded. "They might well have believed they would be allowed to keep their white cloaks once I'd won, perhaps even be honoured with lordships and a higher place at court. I sent them to the wall instead. I wanted no oath-breakers around me, then or now. Sir Lucamore, you swore a sacred vow before gods and men to defend me and mine with your own life, to obey me, fight for me, die for me if need be. You also swore to take no wife, father no children, and remain chaste. If you could shrug aside the second vow so easily, why should I believe that you would honour the first?" Then Queen Alysanne spoke up, saying, "You made a mockery of your oaths as a knight of the King's Guard. But those were not the only vows you broke. You dishonoured your marriage vows as well, not once, but thrice. None of these women are lawfully wed, so these children I see behind you are bastards, one and all. They are the true innocents in this, sir. Your wives were ignorant of one another, I am told, but each of them must surely have known that you are a white sword, a knight of the King's Guard. To that extent they share your guilt, as does whatever drunken Septon you found to marry you. For them some mercy may be warranted, but for you, I will not have you near my lord, sir." There was no more to be said. As the false knight's wives and children wept, or cursed, or stood in silence, Jaehaerys commanded that Sir Lucamore be gelded forthwith, then clapped in irons and sent off to the wall. "The night's watch will require vows from you as well," his grace warned. "See that you keep them, or the next thing you lose shall be your head." Jaehaerys left it to his queen to deal with the three families. Alysanne decreed that Sir Lucamore's sons might join their father on the wall if they wished. The two oldest boys chose to do so. The girls would be accepted as novices by the faith, if that was their desire. Only one elected that path. The other children were to remain with their mothers. The first of the wives with her children was given over to the charge of Lucamore's brother Bywin, who had been raised to be the Lord of Harrenhal not half a year earlier. The second wife and her offspring would go to Driftmark, to be fostered by Daemon Valerian, Lord of the Tides. The third wife, whose children were the youngest, one still on her breast, would be sent down to Storm's End, where Garen Baratheon and young Lord Boromond would see to their upbringing. None were ever again to call themselves strong, the queen decreed. From this day they would bear the bastard names Rivers, Waters, and Storm. For that gift you may thank your father, that hollow knight. The shame that Lucamore the Lusty visited on the King's Guard and the crown was not the only difficulty Jaehaerys and Alysanne faced in 73 AC. Let us pause now for a moment and consider the vexing question of their seventh and eighth-born children, Prince Vagon and Princess Daela. Queen Alysanne took great pride in arranging marriages, and had put together hundreds of fruitful unions for lords and ladies from one end of the realm to another, but never had she faced so much difficulty as she did whilst searching for mates for her four younger children. The struggle would torment her for years, bring about no end of conflict between her and the children, her daughters in particular, drive her and the king apart, and in the end bring her so much grief and pain that for a time her grace contemplated renouncing her marriage to spend the rest of her life with the Silent Sisters. The frustrations started with Vagon and Daela. Only a year apart in age, the prince and princess seemed well matched as babes, and the king and queen assumed that the two of them would eventually marry. Their older siblings, Balon and Alyssa, had become inseparable, and plans were already being made for them to wed. Why not Vagon and Daela as well? "Be sweet to your little sister," King Jaehaerys told the prince when he was five. "One day she will be your Alysanne." As the children grew, however, it became apparent that the two of them were not ideally suited. There was no warmth between them, as the queen saw plainly. Vagon tolerated his sister's presence, but never sought it out. Daela seemed frightened of her sour, bookish brother, who would sooner read than play. The prince thought the princess stupid. She thought him mean. "They are only children," Jaehaerys said when Alysanne brought the problem to his attention. "They will warm to one another in time." They never did. If anything, their mutual dislike only deepened. The matter came to a head in 73 AC. Prince Vagon was 10 years old and Princess Daela 9 when one of the queen's companions, new to the Red Keep, teasingly asked the two of them when they would be married. Vagon reacted as if he had been slapped. "I would never marry her," the boy said in front of half the court. "She can barely read. She should find some lord in need of stupid children, for that's the only sort he will ever have of her." Princess Daela, as might be expected, burst into tears and fled the hall, with her mother, the queen, rushing after her. It fell to her sister, Alyssa, at 13, 3 years Vagon's elder, to pour a flagon of wine over his head. Even that did not make the prince repent. "You are wasting Arbor Gold," was all he said before stalking from the hall to change his clothing. Plainly, the king and queen concluded afterward, some other bride must needs be found for Vagon. Briefly, they considered their younger daughters. Princess Sarah was 6 years old in 73 AC. Princess Viserra, only 2. "Vagon has never looked twice at either one of them," Alysanne told the king. "I am not sure he is aware that they exist. Perhaps if some maester wrote about them in a book." "I shall tell Grand Maester Eleazar to commence tomorrow," the king japed. Then he said, "He is only 10. He does not see girls no more than they see him. But that will change soon. He is comely enough, and a prince of Westeros, third in line to the Iron Throne. In a few more years maidens will be fluttering around him like butterflies, and blushing if he deigns to look their way." The queen was unconvinced. Comely was perhaps too generous a word for Prince Vagon, who had the silver-gold hair and purple eyes of the Targaryens, but was long of face and round of shoulder even at 10, with a pinched, sour cast to his mouth that made men suspect he had recently been sucking on a lemon. As his mother, her grace was mayhaps blind to these flaws, but not to his nature. "I fear for any butterfly that comes fluttering round Vagon. He is like to squash it flat beneath a book." "He spends too much time in the library," Jaehaerys said. "Let me speak to Balon. We will get him out into the yard, put a sword in his hand and a shield on his arm. That will set him right." "Grand Maester Eleazar tells me that his grace did indeed speak to Prince Balon, who dutifully took his brother under his wing, marched him out into the yard, put a sword into his hand and a shield upon his arm. It did not set him right. Vagon hated it. He was a miserable fighter, and he had a gift for making everyone around him miserable as well, even Balon the Brave." Balon persisted for a year at the king's insistence. "The more he drills, the worse he looks," the Spring Prince confessed. One day, mayhaps in an attempt to spur Vagon into making more of an effort, he brought his sister Alyssa to the yard, shining in man's mail. The princess had not forgotten the incident of the Arbor Gold. Laughing and shouting mockery, she danced around her little brother and humiliated him 50 times, whilst Princess Daela looked down from a window. Shamed beyond endurance, Vagon threw down his sword and ran from the yard, never to return. We shall return to Prince Vagon and his sister Daela in due course, but let us turn now to a joyful event. In 74 AC, King Jaehaerys and Queen Alysanne were blessed again by the gods when Prince Aemon's wife, the Lady Jocelyn, presented them with their first grandchild. Princess Rhaenys was born on the 7th day of the 7th moon of the year, which the Septons judged to be highly auspicious. Large and fierce, she had the black hair of her Baratheon mother and the pale violet eyes of her Targaryen father. As the first-born child of the Prince of Dragonstone, many hailed her as next in line for the Iron Throne after her father. When Queen Alysanne held her in her arms for the first time, she was heard to call the little girl our queen-to-be. In breeding, as in so much else, Balon the Brave was not far behind his brother Aemon. In 75 AC, the Red Keep was the site of another splendid wedding, as the Spring Prince took to bride the eldest of his sisters, Princess Alyssa. The bride was 15, the groom 18. Unlike their father and mother, Balon and Alyssa did not wait to consummate their union. The bedding that followed their wedding feast was the source of much ribald humour in the days that followed, for the young bride's sounds of pleasure could be heard all the way to Duskendale, men said. A Shire maid might have been abashed by that. But Alyssa Targaryen was as bawdy a wench as any barmaid in King's Landing, as she herself was fond of boasting. "I mounted him and took him for a ride," she declared the morning after the bedding, "and I mean to do the same tonight. I love to ride." Nor was her brave prince the only mount the princess was to claim that year. Like her brothers before her, Alyssa Targaryen meant to be a dragon rider, and sooner rather than later. Aemon had flown at 17, Balon at 16. Alyssa meant to do it at 15. According to the tales set down by the dragon keepers, it was all that they could do to persuade her not to claim Valerian. "He is old and slow, princess," they had to tell her. "Surely you want a swifter mount?" In the end, they prevailed, and Princess Alyssa ascended into the sky upon Meliz, a splendid scarlet she-dragon never before ridden. "Red maidens, the two of us," the princess boasted, laughing. "But now we've both been mounted." The princess was seldom long away from the dragon pit after that day. Flying was the second sweetest thing in the world, she would oft say, and the very sweetest thing could not be mentioned in the company of ladies. The dragon keepers had not been wrong. Meliz was as swift a dragon as Westeros had ever seen, easily outpacing Caraxes and Vhagar when she and her brothers flew together. Meanwhile, the problem of their brother Vhagar persisted, to the queen's frustration. The king had not been entirely wrong about the butterflies. As the years passed and Vhagar matured, young ladies at the court began to pay him some attention. Age, and some uncomfortable discussions with his father and his brothers, had taught the prince the rudiments of courtesy, and he did not squash any of the girls to the queen's relief. But he took no special notice of any of them either. Books remained his only passion. History, cartography, mathematics, languages. Grand Maester Elizar, never a slave to propriety, confessed to having given the prince a volume of erotic drawings, thinking mayhaps that pictures of naked maidens comporting with men and beasts and one another might kindle Vagon's interest in the charms of women. The prince kept the book, but showed no change in behaviour. It was on Prince Vagon's 15th name day in 78 AC, a year short of his manhood, that Jaehaerys and Alysanne broached the obvious solution to the Grand Maester. "Do you think, mayhaps, Vhagar might have the makings of a maester?" "No," Elizar replied bluntly. "Can you see him instructing some lord's children how to read and write and do simple sums? Does he keep a raven in his chamber or any sort of bird? Can you imagine him removing a man's crushed leg or delivering a baby? All these are required of a maester." The Grand Maester paused, then said, "Vhagar is no maester. But he could well have the makings of an archmaester in him. The citadel is the greatest repository of knowledge in the known world. Send him there. Mayhaps he will find himself in the library. That, or he'll get so lost amongst the books that you never need to concern yourselves with him again." His words struck home. 3 days later, King Jaehaerys summoned Prince Vhagar to his solar to tell him that he would be taking ship for Old Town in a fortnight. "The citadel will take charge of you," his grace said. "It is for you to determine what becomes of you." The prince responded curtly, as was his wont. "Yes, father. Good." Afterward, Jaehaerys told the queen that he thought Vhagar had almost smiled. Prince Balon had not ceased smiling since his marriage. When not aloft, Balon and Alyssa spent every hour together, most oft in their bedchamber. Prince Balon was a lusty lad, for those same shrieks of pleasure that had echoed through the halls of the Red Keep on the night of their bedding were heard many another night in the years that followed. And soon enough the much-hoped-for result appeared, and Alyssa Targaryen grew great with child. In 77 AC she gave her brave prince a son they named Viserys. Septon Barth described the boy as a plump and pleasant lad who laughed more than any babe I've ever known, and nursed so lustily he drank his wet nurse dry. Against all advice, his mother clapped the boy in swaddling clothes, strapped him to her chest and took him aloft on Meli's when he was 9 days old, after which she claimed Viserys giggled the whole time. Bearing and delivering a child may be a joy for a young woman of 10 and 7, like the Princess Alyssa, but it is quite another matter for one of 40, like her mother, Queen Alysanne. The joy was therefore not entirely unalloyed when Her Grace was found to be pregnant once again. Prince Valerian was born in 77 AC, after another troubled labour that saw Alysanne confined to her bed for half a year. Like his brother Gaemon, 4 years earlier, he was a small and sickly babe and never thrived. Half a dozen wet nurses came and went, to no avail. In 78 AC, Valerian died, a fortnight short of his first name day. The queen took his passing with resignation. "I am 42 years old," she told the king. "You must be content with the children I have given you. I am more suited to be a grandmother than a mother now, I fear." King Jaehaerys did not share her certainty. "Our mother, Queen Alyssa, was 46 when she gave birth to Jocelyn," he pointed out to Grand Maester Elisar. "The gods may not be done with us." He was not wrong. The very next year the Grand Maester informed Queen Alysanne that she was once more with child, to her surprise and dismay. Princess Gael was born in 80 AC when the queen was 44. Called the Winter Child for the season of her birth, and because the queen was in the winter of her childbearing years, some said, she was small, pale, and frail. But Grand Maester Elisar was determined that she would not suffer the fate of her brothers Gaemon and Valerian. Nor did she. Assisted by Septa Lyra, who watched over the babe night and day, Elisar nursed the princess through a difficult first year, until finally it seemed as if she might survive. When she reached her first name day, still healthy if not strong, Queen Alysanne thanked the gods. She was thankful as well that year to have finally arranged a marriage for her 8th-born child, the Princess Daella. With Vagon settled, Daella had been next in line, but the tearful princess presented an entirely different sort of problem. "My little flower," was how the queen described her. Like Alysanne herself, Daella was small. On her toes she stood 5 feet 2 inches, and there was a childish aspect to her that led everyone who met her to think she was younger than her age. Unlike Alysanne, she was delicate as well, in ways the queen had never been. Her mother had been fearless. Daella always seemed to be afraid. She had a kitten that she loved until he scratched her. Then she would not go near a cat. The dragons terrified her, even Silverwing. The mildest scolding would reduce her to tears. Once, in the halls of the Red Keep, Daella had encountered a prince from the Summer Isles in his feathered cloak and squealed in terror. His black skin had made her take him for a demon. Cruel though her brother Vagon's words had been, there was some truth to them. Daella was not clever, even her scepter had to admit. She learned to read after a fashion, but haltingly, and without full comprehension. She could not seem to commit even the simplest prayers to memory. She had a sweet voice, but was afraid to sing. She always got the words wrong. She loved flowers, but was frightened of gardens. A bee had almost stung her once. Jaehaerys, even more than Alysanne, despaired of her. "She will not even speak to a boy. How is she to marry? We could entrust her to the faith, but she does not know her prayers, and her scepter says that she cries when asked to read aloud from the 7-pointed star." The queen always rose to her defence. "Daella is sweet and kind and gentle. She has such a tender heart. Give me time, and I will find a lord to cherish her. Not every Targaryen needs to wield a sword and ride a dragon." In the years that followed her first flowering, Daella Targaryen drew the eye of many a young lordling, as expected. She was a king's daughter, and maidenhood had only made her prettier. Her mother was at work as well, arranging matters in every way she could to place suitable marriage prospects before the princess. At 13, Daella was sent to Driftmark to meet Corlys Valerian, the grandson to the Lord of the Tides. 10 years her elder, the future Sea Snake, was already a celebrated mariner and captain of ships. Daella became seasick, crossing Blackwater Bay, however, and on her return complained that "he likes his boats better than he likes me." She was not wrong in that. At 14, she kept company with Dennis Swan, Simon Staunton, Gerald Templeton, and Ellard Crane, all promising squires of her own age. But Staunton tried to make her drink wine, and Crane kissed her on the lips without her leave, reducing her to tears. By year's end, Dala had decided she hated all of them. At 15, her mother took her across the Riverlands to Raventree, in a wheelhouse, as Dala was afraid of horses, where Lord Blackwood entertained Queen Alisande lavishly whilst his son paid court to the princess. Tall, graceful, courtly, and well-spoken, Royce Blackwood was a gifted bowman, a fine swordsman, and a singer, who melted Dala's heart with ballads of his own composition. For a short while it seemed as if a betrothal might be in the offing, and Queen Alisande and Lord Blackwood even began to discuss wedding plans. It all fell to pieces when Dala learned that the Blackwoods kept the old gods, and she would be expected to say her vows before a Weirwood. "They don't believe in the gods," she told her mother, horrified. "I'd go to hell." Her 16th name day was fast approaching, and with it her womanhood. Queen Alisande was at her wit's end, and the king had lost his patience. On the first day of the 80th year since Aegon's conquest, he told the queen he wanted Dala wed before the year's end. "If she wants, I can find 100 men and line them up before her naked, and she can pick the one she likes," he said. "I would sooner she wed a lord, but if she prefers a hedge knight or a merchant or Pate the pig boy, I am past the point of caring, so long as she picks someone." 100 naked men would frighten her," Alisande said, unamused. 100 naked ducks would frighten her," the king replied. "And if she will not wed?" the queen asked. "Maegal says the faith will not want a girl who cannot read her prayers." "There are still the Silent Sisters," said Jaehaerys. "Must it come to that?" "Find her someone. Someone gentle, as she is. A kind man who will never raise his voice or his hand to her, who will speak to her sweetly and tell her she is precious and protect her against dragons and horses and bees and kittens and boys with boils and whatever else she fears." "I shall do my best, Your Grace," Queen Alisande promised. In the end it did not require 100 men, naked or clothed. The queen explained the king's command to Dala gently but firmly, and offered her a choice of 3 suitors, each of whom was eager for her hand. Pate the pig boy was not amongst them, it should be said. The 3 men that Alisande had selected were great lords or the sons of great lords. Whichever man she married, Dala would have wealth and position. Boromund Baratheon was the most imposing of the candidates. At 28, the Lord of Storm's End was the image of his father, brawny and powerful, with a booming laugh, a great black beard, and a mane of thick black hair. As the son of Lord Rhaegar by Queen Alyssa, he stood half-brother to Alisande and Jaehaerys, and Dala knew and loved his sister, Jocelyn, from her years at court, which was thought to be much in his favour. Sir Tymond Lannister was the wealthiest contender, heir to Casterly Rock and all its gold. At 20 he was nearer to Dala's own age, and thought to be one of the handsomest men in all the realm, lithe and slender, with long golden moustachios and hair of the same hue, always clad in silk and satin. The princess would be well protected in Casterly Rock. There was no castle more impregnable in all Westeros. Weighed against Lannister gold and Lannister beauty, however, was Sir Tymond's own reputation. He was overly fond of women, it was said, and even more fond of wine. Last of the 3, and least in many eyes, was Roderick Arryn, Lord of the Eyrie and Protector of the Vale. He had been a lord since the age of 10, a point in his favour. For the past 20 years he had served on the small council as Lord Justiciar and Master of Laws, during which time he had become a familiar figure about court, and a leal friend to both king and queen. In the Vale he had been an able lord, strong but just, affable, open-handed, loved by the small folk and his lord's bannermen alike. In addition he had acquitted himself well in King's Landing. Sensible, knowledgeable, good-humoured, he was regarded as a great asset to the council. Lord Arryn was the oldest of the 3 contenders, however. At 36 he was 20 years older than the princess, and a father besides, with 4 children left him by his late first wife. Short and balding, with a kettle belly, Aaron was not the man most maidens dream of, Queen Alisan admitted. But he is the sort you asked for, a kind and gentle man, and he says that he has loved our little girl for years. I know he will protect her. To the astonishment of every woman at the court, save mayhaps the queen, Princess Dela chose Lord Roderick to be her husband. He seems good and wise, like father, she told Queen Alisan. And he has four children. I'm to be their new mother. What her grace thought of that outburst is not recorded. Grand Maester Elazar's account of the day says only, Gods be good. Theirs would not be a long betrothal. As the king had wished, Princess Dela and Lord Roderick were wed before year's end. It was a small ceremony in the Sept at Dragonstone, attended only by close friends and kin. Larger crowds made the princess desperately uncomfortable. Nor was there a bedding. Oh, I could not bear that. I should die of shame, the princess had told her husband to be, and Lord Roderick had acceded to her wishes. Afterward, Lord Arryn took his princess back to the Eyrie. My children need to meet their new mother, and I want to show the veil to Dela. Life is slower there and quieter. She will like that. I swear to you, Your Grace, she will be safe and happy. And so she was, for a time. The eldest of Lord Roderick's four children from his first wife was a daughter, Ellis, 3 years older than her new stepmother. The two of them clashed from the first. Dela doted on the three younger children, however, and they seemed to adore her in turn. Lord Roderick, true to his word, was a kind and caring husband, who never failed to pamper and protect the bride he called my precious princess. Such letters as Dela sent her mother, letters largely written for her by Lord Roderick's younger daughter Amanda, spoke glowingly of how happy she was, how beautiful the veil, how much she loved her lord's sweet sons, how everyone in the Eyrie was so kind to her. Prince Aemon reached his 26th name day in 81 AC, and had proved himself more than able in both war and peace. As the heir apparent to the Iron Throne, it was felt desirable that he take a greater role in the governance of the realm as a member of the King's Council. Accordingly, King Jaehaerys named the prince his Justiciar and Master of Laws, in place of Roderick Arryn. I will leave the making of law to you, brother, Prince Balon declared, whilst drinking to Prince Aemon's appointment. I would sooner make sons. And that was just what he did, for later that same year Princess Alyssa bore her spring prince a second son, who was given the name Daemon. His mother, irrepressible as ever, took the babe into the sky on Meles within a fortnight of his birth, just as she had done with his brother Viserys. In the Vale, however, her sister Daela was not doing near as well. After a year and a half of marriage, a different sort of message arrived at the Red Keep by Raven. It was very short, and written in Daela's own uncertain hand. I am with child, it said. Mother, please come. I am frightened. Queen Alisan was frightened, too, once she read those words. She mounted Silverwing within days and flew swiftly to the Vale, alighting first in Gulltown before proceeding on to the Gates of the Moon, and then skyward to the Eyrie. It was 82 AC, and Her Grace arrived 3 moons before Dela was due to give birth. Though the princess professed delight that her mother had come, and apologized for sending her such a silly letter, her fear was palpable. She burst into tears for the slightest reason, and sometimes for no reason at all, Lord Roderick said. His daughter Ellis was dismissive, telling Her Grace, you would think she was the first woman ever to have a baby. But Alisan was concerned. Dela was so delicate, and she was carrying very heavy. She is such a small girl, for such a big belly, she wrote the king. I would be frightened too if I were her. Queen Alisan stayed beside the princess for the rest of her confinement, sitting by her bedside, reading her to sleep at night, and comforting her fears. It will be fine, she told her daughter 50 times. She will be a girl, wait and see. A daughter, I know it. Everything will be fine. She was half right. Emma Arryn, the daughter of Lord Roderick and Princess Dela, came into the world a fortnight early after a long and troubled labour. "It hurts," the princess screamed through half the night. "It hurts so much." But it is said she smiled when her daughter was laid against her breast. Everything was far from fine, however. Childbed fever set in soon after birth. Though Princess Daela desperately wished to nurse her child, she had no milk, and a wet nurse was sent for. As her fever rose, the maester decreed that she might not even hold her babe, which set the princess to weeping. She wept until she fell asleep, but in her sleep she kicked wildly and tossed and turned, her fever rising ever higher. By morning she was gone. She was 18 years of age. Lord Roderick wept as well, and begged the queen's permission to bury his precious princess in the vale, but Alessandre refused. "She was the blood of the dragon. She will be burned, and her ashes interred on Dragonstone beside her sister Daenerys." Daela's death tore the heart out of the queen, but as we look back, it is plain to see that it was also the first hint of the rift that would open between her and her king. The gods hold us all in their hands, and life and death are theirs to give and take away. But men in their pride look for others to blame. Alysanne Targaryen, in her grief, blamed herself and Lord Arryn and the Eyrie's maester for their parts in her daughter's demise. But most of all, she blamed Jaehaerys. If he had not insisted that Daela wed, that she pick someone before year's end, what harm would it have done for her to stay a little girl for another year or two, or 10? She was not old enough or strong enough to bear a child, she told his grace back at King's Landing. We ought never have pushed her into marriage. It is not recorded how the king replied. The 83rd year after Aegon's conquest is remembered as the year of the 4th Dornish War, better known amongst the small folk as Prince Morion's Madness, or the War of the Hundred Candles. The old Prince of Dorne had died, and his son, Morion Martell, had succeeded him in Sunspear. A rash and foolish young man, Prince Morion had long bristled at his father's cowardice during Lord Rogar's War, when knights of the Seven Kingdoms had marched into the Red Mountains unmolested, whilst the Dornish armies stayed at home and left the Vulture King to his fate. Determined to avenge this stain on Dornish honour, the prince planned his own invasion of the Seven Kingdoms. Though he knew Dorne could not hope to prevail against the might that the Iron Throne could muster against him, Prince Morion thought that he might take King Jaehaerys unawares and conquer the Stormlands as far as Storm's End, or at very least Cape Wrath. Rather than attack by way of the prince's pass, he planned to come by sea. He would assemble his hosts on Ghost Hill and the Tor, load them on ships and sail them across the Sea of Dawn to take the Stormlanders by surprise. If he was defeated or driven back, so be it. But before he went, he swore to burn 100 towns and raise 100 castles so the Stormlanders might know that they could never again march into the Red Mountains with impunity. The madness of this plan can be seen in the fact that there are neither 100 towns nor 100 castles on Cape Wrath, nor even a third that number. Dorne had not boasted any strength at sea since Nymeria burned her 10,000 ships, but Prince Morion did have gold, and he found willing allies in the pirates of the Stepstones, the Sellsails of Myr, and the corsairs of the Pepper Coast. Though it took him the best part of a year, eventually the ships came straggling in, and the prince and his spearmen were loaded aboard. Morion had been weaned on the tales of past, Dornish glory, and like many young Dornish lords, he had seen the sun-mottled bones of the dragon Meraxes at the Hellholt. Every ship in his fleet was therefore manned with crossbowmen and equipped with massive scorpions of the sort that had felled Meraxes. If the Targaryens dared to send dragons against him, he would fill the air with bolts and kill them all. The folly of Prince Morion's plans cannot be overstated. His hopes of taking the Iron Throne unawares were laughable for a start. Not only did Jaehaerys have spies in Morion's own court and friends amongst the shrewder Dornish lords, but the pirates of the Stepstones, the Sellsails of Myr, and the corsairs of the Pepper Coast are none of them famed for their discretion. A few coins changing hands was all it took. By the time Morion set sail, the king had known of his attack for half a year. Boromund Baratheon, Lord of Storm's End, had been made aware as well, and was waiting on Cape Wrath to give the Dornishmen a red welcome when they came ashore. He would never have the chance. Jaehaerys Targaryen and his sons Aemon and Baelon had been waiting as well, and as Morion's fleet beat its way across the Sea of Dawn, the dragons Vermithor, Caraxes, and Vhagar fell on them from out of the clouds. Shouts rang out, and the Dornish filled the air with scorpion boats, but firing at a dragon is one thing, and killing it quite another. A few bolts glanced off the scales of the dragons, and one punched through Vhagar's wing, but none of them found any vulnerable spots as the dragons swooped and banked and loosed great blasts of fire. One by one, the ships went up in gouts of flame. They were still burning when the sun went down, like 100 candles floating on the sea. Burned bodies would wash up on the shores of Cape Wrath for half a year, but not a single living Dornishman set foot upon the Stormlands. The fourth Dornish war was fought and won in a single day. The pirates of the Stepstones, the Sellsails of Myr, and the corsairs of the Pepper Coast became less troublesome for a time, and Mara Martell became the Princess of Dawn. Back in King's Landing, King Jaehaerys and his sons received a riotous welcome. Even Aegon the Conqueror had never won a war without losing a man. Prince Baelon had another cause for celebration as well. His wife Alyssa was again with child. This time, he told his brother Aemon, he was praying for a girl. Princess Alyssa was brought to bed again in 84 AC. After a long and difficult labour, she gave Prince Baelon a third son, a boy they named Aegon, after the Conqueror. "They call me Baelon the Brave," the prince told his wife at her bedside, "but you are far braver than me. I would sooner fight a dozen battles than do what you've just done." Alyssa laughed at him. "You were made for battles, and I was made for this. Viserys and Daemon and Aegon, that's three. As soon as I am well, let's make another. I want to give you 20 sons, an army of your own." It was not to be. Alyssa Targaryen had a warrior's heart in a woman's body, and her strength failed her. She never fully recovered from Aegon's birth, and died within the year at only 24. Nor did Prince Aegon long survive her. He perished half a year later, still shy of his first name day. Though shattered by his loss, Baelon took solace in the two strong sons that she had left him, Viserys and Daemon, and never ceased to honour the memory of his sweet lady with a broken nose and mismatched eyes. And now, I fear, we must turn our attention to one of the most troubling and distasteful chapters in the long reign of King Jaehaerys and Queen Alysanne. The matter of their ninth-born child, the Princess Sarah. Born in 67 AC, 3 years after Daella, Sarah had all the courage that her sister lacked, along with a voracious hunger for milk, for food, for affection, for praise. As a babe, she did not so much cry as scream, and her ear-piercing wails became the terror of every maid in the Red Keep. "She wants what she wants, and she wants it now," Grand Maester Elizar wrote of the princess in 69 AC, when she was only 2. "Seven save us all when she is older. The dragon keepers had best lock up the dragons." He had no notion how prophetic those words would be. Septon Barth was more reflective as he observed the princess at the age of 12 in 79 AC. "She is the king's daughter and well aware of it. Servants see to her every need, though not always as quickly as she might like. Great lords and handsome knights show her every courtesy. The ladies of the court defer to her. Girls of her own age vie with one another to be her friends. All of this Sarah takes as her due. If she were the king's firstborn, or better still, his only child, she would be well content. Instead, she finds herself the ninth-born, with 6 living siblings who are older than her and even more adored. Aemon is to be king. Baelon, most like, will be his hand. Alyssa may be all her mother is and more. Vhagon is more learned than she is. Maegel is holier, and Daella? When does a day go by when Daella is not in need of comfort? And whilst she is being soothed, Sarah is being ignored. Such a fierce little thing she is, they say, she has no need of comfort. They are wrong in that, I fear. All men need comfort. Arya Targaryen had once been thought to be wild and willful, given to acts of disobedience. But Princess Sarah's girlhood made Arya seem a model of decorum by comparison. The border between innocent pranks, wanton mischief and acts of malice is not always discerned by one so young, but there can be no doubt that the princess crossed it freely. She was forever sneaking cats into her sister Daela's bedchamber, knowing that she was frightened of them. Once she filled Daela's chamber pot with bees. She slipped into White Sword Tower when she was 10, stole all the white cloaks she could find, and dyed them pink. At 7, she learned when and how to steal into the kitchens to make off with cakes and pies and other treats. Before she was 11, she was stealing wine and ale instead. By 12, she was like as not to arrive drunk when summoned to the Sept for prayer. The king's half-witted fool, Tom Turnip, was the victim of many of her japes and her unwitting cat's paw for others. Once, before a great feast where many lords and ladies were to be in attendance, she persuaded Tom that it would be much funnier if he performed naked. It was not well received. Later, far more cruelly, she told him that if he climbed the Iron Throne, he could be king. But the fool was clumsy at the best of times and prone to tremors, and the throne sliced his arms and legs to pieces. "She is an evil child," her scepter said of her afterward. Princess Sarah had half a dozen scepters and as many bedmaids before she turned 13. That is not to say that the princess was without her virtues. Her maesters affirmed that she was very clever, as bright as her brother Vagon in her own way. She was certainly pretty, taller than her sister Daela, and not half so delicate, and as strong and quick and spirited as her sister Elisa. When she wanted to be charming, it was hard to resist her. Her big brothers, Aemon and Balon, never failed to be amused by her mischief, though they never knew the worst of it. And long before she was half-grown, Sarah had learned the art of getting anything she wanted from her father. A kitten, a hound, a pony, a hawk, a horse. Jaehaerys did draw a firm line at the elephant. Queen Alysanne was far less gullible, however, and Septon Barth tells us that Sarah's sisters all misliked her to various degrees. Maidenhood became her, and Sarah truly came into her own after her first flowering. After all they had endured with Daela, the king and queen must have been relieved to see how eagerly Sarah took to the young men of the court, and they to her. At 14 she told the king she meant to marry the Prince of Dawn, or perhaps the King Beyond the Wall, so she could be a queen like mother. That year a trader from the Summer Islands came to court. Far from shrieking at the sight of him, as Daela had, Sarah said she might like to marry him, too. By 15 she had put such idle fantasies aside. Why dream of distant monarchs, when she could have as many squires, knights, and likely lords as she desired? Dozens danced attendance on her, but 3 soon emerged as favourites. Jonah Mouton was the heir to Maidenpool, Red Roy Connington was the 15-year-old Lord of Griffin's Roost, and Braxton Beesbury, called Stinger, was a 19-year-old knight, the finest lance in the Reach, and the heir to Honeyholt. The princess had female favourites as well. Perianne Moore and Alice Turnberry, 2 maids of her own age, became her dearest friends. Sarah called them Pretty Perry and Sweet Perry. For more than a year, the 3 maids and the 3 young lords were inseparable at every feast and ball. They hunted and hawked together, too, and once sailed across Blackwater Bay to Dragonstone. When the 3 lords rode at rings or crossed swords in the yards, the 3 maids were there to cheer them on. King Jaehaerys, who was forever entertaining visiting lords or envoys from across the narrow sea, sitting at council or planning further roads, was well pleased. They would not need to scour the realm to find a match for Sarah, when 3 such promising young men were here at hand. Queen Alysanne was less convinced. "Sarah is clever, but not wise," she told the king. Lady Perianne and Lady Alice were pretty, vapid, empty-headed little fools from what she had seen of them, whilst Connington and Mouton were callow boys. "And I do not like this Stinger. I've heard he's sired a bastard in the Reach, and another here in King's Landing. Jaehaerys remained unconcerned. It is not as if Sarah were ever alone with any of them. There are always people about, serving men and maids, grooms and men-at-arms. What mischief can they get up to with so many eyes around them? He did not like the answer when it came. One of Sarah's japes was their undoing. On a warm spring night in 84 AC, shouts and screams from a brothel called the Blue Pearl drew the notice of two men of the city watch. The screams were coming from Tom Turnip, who was lurching helplessly in circles trying to escape from half a dozen naked whores, whilst the patrons of the house laughed uproariously and shouted on the harlots. Jonah Mouton, Redroy Connington, and Stinger Beesbury were among those patrons, each one drunker than the last. They had thought it would be funny to see old Turnip do the deed, Redroy admitted. Then Jonah Mouton laughed and said the jape had all been Sarah's notion and what a funny girl she was. The watchmen rescued the hapless fool and escorted him back to the Red Keep. The three lords they brought before Sir Robert Redwine, their commander. Sir Robert delivered them to the king, ignoring Stinger's threats and Connington's clumsy attempt to bribe him. "It is never pleasant to lance a boil," Grand Maester Elazar wrote of the affair. "You never know how much pus will come out, or how badly it will smell." The pus that burst forth from the Blue Pearl would smell very badly indeed. The three drunken lords had sobered somewhat by the time the king confronted them from atop the Iron Throne and put up a bold front. They confessed to making off with Tom Turnip and bringing him to the Blue Pearl. None of them said a word concerning Princess Sarah. When His Grace ordered Mouton to repeat what he had said about the princess, he blushed and stammered and claimed the watchmen had misheard. Jaehaerys finally ordered the three lordlings taken to the dungeons. "Let them sleep in a black cell tonight. Mayhaps they will tell a different tale come morning." It was Queen Alysanne, knowing how close Lady Perianne and Lady Alys had been to the three lords, who suggested that they be questioned as well. "Let me speak with them, Your Grace. If they see you up on the throne glaring down at them, they will be so frightened they will never say a word." The hour was late, and her guardsmen found both girls asleep, sharing a bed in Lady Perianne's chambers. The queen had them brought before her in her solar. Their three young lords were in the dungeons, she told the girls. If they did not wish to join them, they would tell the truth. It was all she needed to say. Sweetberry and Pretty Perry stumbled over one another in their eagerness to confess. Before long, both of them were weeping and pleading for forgiveness. Queen Alysanne let them plead, never saying a word. She listened, as she had done before at 100 women's courts. Her Grace knew how to listen. "It was just a game at the start," Pretty Perry said. "Sarah was teaching Alice how to kiss, so I asked if she would teach me too. The boys train at fighting every morning. Why shouldn't we train at kissing? That's what girls are meant to do, isn't it?" Alice Turnberry agreed. "Kissing was sweet," she said, "and one night we started kissing with our clothes off. And that was scary but exciting. We took turns pretending we were boys. We never meant to be wicked. We were only playing. Then Sarah dared me to kiss a real boy, and I dared Perry to do the same, and both of us dared Sarah, but she said she would do us one better. She would kiss a man grown, a knight. That's how it began with Roy and Jonah and Stinger." Lady Perianne jumped back in then to say that afterward it was Stinger who did the training for all of them. "He has two bastards," she whispered, "one in the Reach and one right here on the Street of Silk. Her mother is a whore at the Blue Pearl." That was the only mention of the Blue Pearl. Neither of the Trolls knew the slightest thing concerning poor Tom Turnip, as irony would have it, Grand Maester Elazar would write afterward. But they knew a great deal about certain other things, none of which had been their fault. "Where were your scepters during all of this?" the Queen demanded when she had heard them out. "Where were your maids? And the lords? They would have been attended. Where were their grooms, their men-at-arms, their squires and serving-men?" Lady Perianne was confused by the question. "We told them to wait without," she said. in the tone of one explaining that the sun rises in the east.
They're servants. They do what you tell them.
The ones who knew, they knew to keep quiet. Stinger said he'd have their tongues out if they talked. And Sarah is smarter than the scepters. That was where Sweetberry broke down and began to sob and tear at her dressing gown. She was so sorry, she told the Queen. She had never wanted to be bad. Stinger made her, and Sarah said she was a craven, so she showed them. But now she was with child, and she did not know who the father was, and what was she to do? All you can do tonight is go to bed, Queen Alisande told her. On the morrow we shall send a scepter to you, and you can make confession of your sins. The mother will forgive you.
My mother won't, said Alice Turnberry.
But she went as she was told. Lady Perianne helped her sobbing friend back to her room. When the Queen told him what she had learned, King Jaehaerys could scarce credit a word of it. Guards were sent forth, and a succession of squires, grooms and maids were dragged before the Iron Throne for questioning. Many of them wound up in the dungeons with their masters once their answers had been heard. Dawn had come by the time the last of them had been led away. Only then did the King and Queen send for Princess Sarah. The Princess surely knew that something was amiss when the Lord Commander of the King's Guard and the Commander of the City Watch appeared together to escort her to the throne room. It was never good when the King received you whilst seated on the Iron Throne. The Great Hall was almost empty when she was brought in. Only Grand Maester Elisar and Septon Barth had been summoned to bear witness. They spoke for the Citadel and the Starry Sept, and the King felt a need for their guidance, but there were things like to be said that day that his other lords need never know. It is oft said that the Red Keep has no secrets, that there are rats in the walls who hear everything and whisper in the ears of sleepers by night. Mayhaps so, for when Princess Sarah came before her father, she appeared to know all that had happened at the Blue Pearl, and be not the least abashed. "I told them to do it, but I never thought they would," she said lightly. "That must have been so funny, turnip dancing with the whores."
"Not for Tom," said King Jaehaerys from the Iron Throne.
"He is a fool," Princess Sarah answered with a shrug. "Fools are meant to be laughed at. Where is the harm in that? Turnip loves it when you laugh at him."
"It was a cruel jape," said Queen Alisande. "But just now there are other matters that concern me more. I have been speaking with your ladies. Are you aware that Alice Turnberry is with child?"
It was only then that the Princess came to realize that she was not there to answer for Tom Turnip, but for more shameful sins. For a moment Sarah was at a loss for words, but only for a moment. Then she gasped and said,
"My Sweetberry, truly, oh, what has she done? Oh, my sweet little fool!"
If Septon Barth's testimony is to be believed, a tear rolled down her cheek. Her mother was not moved.
"You know perfectly well what she has done, what all of you have done. We will have the truth from you now, child."
And when the princess looked to her father, she found no comfort there.
"Lie to us again, and it will go very much the worse for you," King Jaehaerys told his daughter. "Your three lords are in the dungeons, you ought know. And what you say next may determine where you sleep tonight."
Sarah crumbled then, and the words came tumbling out one after another in a rush, a flood that left the princess almost breathless. She went from denial to dismissal, to quibbling, to contrition, to accusation, to justification, to defiance, in the space of an hour, with stops at giggling and weeping along the way, Septon Barth would write. "She never did it. They were lying. It never happened. How could they believe that? It was just a game. It was just a jape. Who said that? That was not how it happened. Everyone likes kissing. She was sorry. Perry started it. It was such fun. No one was hurt. No one ever told her kissing was bad. Sweetberry had dared her. She was so ashamed. Balon used to kiss Alyssa all the time. Once she started, she did not know how to stop. She was afraid of Stinger. The mother above had forgiven her. All the girls were doing it. The first time she was drunk, she had never wanted to. It was what men wanted. Miguel said the gods forgave all sins.
Jonah said he loved her. The gods had made her pretty. It was not her fault. She would be good from now on. It will be as if it never happened. She would marry Red Roy Connington. They had to forgive her. She would never kiss a man again or do any of those other things. It wasn't her who was with child. She was their daughter. She was their little girl. She was a princess. If she were queen, she would do as she liked. Why wouldn't they believe her? They never loved her. She hated them. They could whip her if they wanted, but she would never be their slave. She took my breath away, this girl. There was never a mummer in all the land who gave such a performance. But by the end, she was exhausted and afraid, and her mask slipped. "What have you done?" the king said, when at last the princess ran out of words. "Seven Savers, what have you done? Have you given one of these boys your maidenhead? Tell me true."
"True," said Sarah.
It was in that moment, with that word, that the contempt came out.
"No, I gave it to all three. They all think they were the first.
Boys are such silly fools." Jaehaerys was so horrified he could not speak. But the queen kept her composure.
"You are very proud of yourself, I see. A woman grown, and nearly 7 and 10. I am sure you think you have been very clever. But it is one thing to be clever, and another to be wise. What do you imagine will happen now, Sarah?"
"I will be married," the princess said. "Why shouldn't I be? You are married at my age. I shall be wedded and bedded. But to whom? Jonah and Roy both love me. I could take one of them, but they are both such boys. Stinger does not love me, but he makes me laugh and sometimes makes me scream. I could marry all three of them. Why not? Why should I have just one husband? The Conqueror had 2 wives, and Maegor had 6 or 8.
She had gone too far. Jaehaerys rose to his feet and descended from the Iron Throne, his face a mask of rage.
"You would compare yourself to Maegor? Is that who you aspire to be?" His Grace had heard enough. "Take her back to her bedchamber," he told his guards, "and keep her there until I send for her again." When the princess heard his words, she rushed toward him, crying, "Father, father!" But Jaehaerys turned his back on her, and Giles Morrigan caught her by the arm and wrenched her away. She would not go of her own accord, so the guards were forced to drag her from the hall, wailing and sobbing and calling for her father. Even then, Septon Barth tells us, Princess Sarah might have been forgiven and restored to favour, if she had done as she was told, if she had remained meekly in her chambers reflecting on her sins and praying for forgiveness. Jaehaerys and Alysanne met all the next day, with Barth and Grand Maester Elisar, discussing what was to be done with the 6 sinners, particularly the princess. The king was angry and unyielding, for his shame was deeply felt, and he could not forget Sarah's taunting words about his uncle's wives. "She is no longer my daughter," he said more than once. Queen Alysanne could not find it in her heart to be so harsh, however.
"She is our daughter," she told the king. "She must be punished, yes, but she is still a child, and where there is sin there can be redemption. My lord, my love, you reconciled with the lords who fought for your uncle. You forgave the men who rode with Septon Moon. You reconciled with the faith, and with Lord Rhaegar when he tried to tear us apart and put Arya on your throne. Surely you can find some way to reconcile with your own daughter."
Her Grace's words were soft and gentle, and Jaehaerys was moved by them, Septon Barth tells us. Alysanne was stubborn and persistent, and she had a way of bringing the king around to her own point of view, no matter how far apart they had been at the start. Given time, she might have softened his stance on Sarah as well. She would not have that time. That very night, Princess Sarah sealed her fate. Instead of remaining in her rooms as she had been instructed, she slipped away whilst visiting the privy, donned a washerwoman's robes, stole a horse from the stables, and escaped the castle. She got halfway across the city to the Hill of Rhaenys, but as she tried to enter the dragon pit, she was found and taken by the dragon keepers and returned to the Red Keep. Alysanne wept when she heard, for she knew her cause was hopeless.
Jaehaerys was hard as stone. "Sarah with a dragon," was all he had to say. Would she have taken Beleriand as well, I wonder? This time the princess was not allowed to return to her own chambers. She was confined to a tower cell instead, with John